water treatment has just been neglected, not just by governments, but also by donors.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. More people die from contaminated drinking water and poor sanitation than from water-related disasters. As Sustainable Development Goal 6 aims to help the 2 billion people who do not have safe drinking water, but the United Nations has described the lack of progress to meeting Goal 6 as very alarming. So what are the consequences if we don't provide safe drinking water, especially for children? And what technologies and policies would be able to accelerate some change? In the first of a series of collaborations with J-PAL to discuss their policy insights on important topics in development, I'm speaking to Pascaline Dupin of Princeton. She is scientific director for J-PAL Africa and was one of the authors of a J-PAL policy insight on the problems of access to clean water and how that access might be improved. Pascaline, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Pascaline, what are the consequences of unsafe water, especially for children?
Well, the consequences are very bad for health. I mean, we all know that. We don't want to drink water that's not potable because it contains contaminants. It contains germs that makes us sick. And so today we have about 2.2 billion people worldwide that lack access to safely managed drinking water. Mm-hmm. That means every year it's estimated about 1.7 billion cases of diarrhea affecting children younger than five because of microbiological contamination of water through fecal matter primarily. And so that's just not good for very, very young children. Diarrhea can actually cause death. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, contaminated drinking water is a major killer of children.
Can we measure other consequences? I'm thinking of things like school attendance if children get sick.
In principle, you can measure that. Yeah. And there are a number of pathways through which you would think attendance at school and learning in school would be impacted. One is if children with diarrhea don't feel well enough to attend school, or if they are asked to stay home to watch younger siblings feeling unwell, or even if household resources are spent on treating diarrhea, that reduces resources to pay school fees or other schooling inputs that matter. Now, to the best of my knowledge, there's no randomized controlled trial that has looked at these effects. Neither direct impact immediately on attendance, nor other long-term impact of exposure to cleaner water in early childhood. But there are some observational studies that suggest potentially large effects. I know of one paper published in the JDE that looks at the long-term impacts of a major water treatment program in China in the 80s. And they do find important educational benefits for rural youth, especially for girls. There's another working paper in Mexico that looks at the major clean water reform that happened in the 90s. They also find suggestive effects. Now, both of these studies potentially will have issues of identification, as we call it, because they are comparing villages that got the program with villages that did not get the program, but it was not placed randomly. So there could be some other factors. And so it's hard to really be completely sure of the magnitude of these effects. The jury is still out, and it would be really wonderful to have long-term studies looking at this and studies looking at educational effects. It's a health program that affects education. Mm-hmm. Often people don't think of looking at that, or, you know, no one wants to pay for it because the Ministry of Health is going to say, well, this is a health program, so I'm not going to pay for a study that looks at education. And the education ministry is going to be like, well, this is, you know, a health program, so I don't want to pay for it. So often when you have these cross-cutting programs, they kind of fall through the cracks.
That naive question, we've known how to purify water for hundreds of years, centuries now. So why are so many water sources still unsafe?
Well, I think it's in part because of what I just said, this intersectionality.
Yeah.
Water treatment is at the intersection of two sectors, health and water. And so again, you can have this war of attrition between the Minister of Health and the Minister of Water, sending the ball to each other for who should be taking care of that. But I think more generally, water treatment has just been neglected, not just by governments, but also by donors. The consequence of this is that, unlike vaccinations or bed nets, most households are not able to access free point-of-use water treatment through the health system. And so neither the infrastructure is there for them to access clean water, no, the point-of-use remedy is available, and that's a huge problem. And so your question is very valid, like, why is it not happening? And I'm hoping that this moment is like a wake-up moment for everyone to be like, no, no, we this is the next item to really take head on.
Well, let's look at some ways to make that happen. And one engineering solution is protecting the natural springs where many people get their water from. What does this mean? What does it imply? How well does it work?
The idea is when the water comes out of the natural spring to just like protect the area and encase it so that the fishes from animals or other human waste cannot come and contaminate it. So that type of protection on the spring can dramatically improve the quality of the water at the source. But then some of this benefit can be lost by the time the water gets to the household because it has to be carried, it has to be transported. And if the containers are not clean or if there's recontamination along the way, then the impact on health is not going to be as high as it could be. And in fact, there is evidence of recontamination when water is transported or stored. But there is another issue with this solution in that it doesn't apply to many households.
Oh, right.
Many households don't get water from a natural spring. Maybe they get water from a lake or from other surface water. Others dig a borehole or a tube well on their compound. And in principle, we think that groundwater is safer for drinking, but it actually can be contaminated. And a lot of studies have shown contamination of groundwater, especially borehole water in areas with high rainfall and shallow water tables are at high risk. And again, they can be close to the house, but you still need to get a container and fetch the water and then bring it home. And so during the fetching and the carrying and the storing in the containers, contamination can happen. In practice, even groundwater needs to be treated to be safe.
So treating that water, that's done by using chlorine, isn't it? How effective is chlorine as a way of treating water to make it safe?
So it's super, super, super effective. In fact, it's the most commonly used disinfectant for the treatment of drinking water. It can provide residual protection for up to 2 days. It works very well, not only because it disinfects, but it also prevents the recontamination that can often occur when the water is handled or stored in homes, as I mentioned before. So that's why it's so effective. It's just, it kills the germs that are there, and then for 2 days, it prevents any new ones to show up. The presence of chlorine really inactivates the majority of these diarrhea-causing pathogens. And the evidence that we have suggests that if you use chlorine at the point of use, which is, you know, actually in a container where you store the water that you are then going to drink. So imagine you have a container with a spigot at the bottom and you treat that water and then the water comes out of the spigot has been treated. That type of point of use chlorination reduces caretaker reported diarrhea by 30 to 40%. And it's relatively easy to use and extremely, extremely, extremely inexpensive. And we now know, thanks to a study that Michael Kremer, a longtime collaborator on this work and a famous Nobel laureate, yes, has done with co-authors, they have a meta-analysis that they've done, which means they've brought together data from many different studies that have looked at the impacts on health. And they estimate that treating water with chlorine averts an average of 1 in 4 child death.
Wow.
So that's like a 25% reduction in mortality, which is quite high. And so, you know, from that, you can do cost-effectiveness analysis. And they found it to be very, very highly cost-effective. And the reason why it's so cost-effective is because on one hand, it's effective. It does reduce mortality. And on the other hand, it's super cheap.
Yeah.
Think of it like a bottle of bleach, you know,
yes,
has enough chlorine to treat 70,000 liters of water. I'm not saying people should just take bleach and put it in their water. That would be terrible.
Yeah, we are not recommending this as an intervention.
Yeah, you want to be super careful because it's so potent. You
know? Yeah.
You don't want to put too much. But the way the chlorine is available when it's available, it's called WaterGuard in Kenya. It's called Sio in Rwanda. It has, you know, different names in different countries, but it's like essentially a bottle of very highly diluted bleach.
Mm-hmm.
And you just have to put a capful of the product into a 20-liter container, and it's super safe. And even if you put twice as much as you should, it's still safe because it's extremely diluted. But the idea that it's so cheap,
yeah,
that's why it's extremely cost effective.
It's so cost effective and it works so well, then I guess the discussion that we have to have is how to make sure that the chlorine gets into the water. Now, there are some public health interventions, aren't there, that put chlorine dispensers next to the water sources that people use when they come and get their water. How does this work? Who provides those chlorine dispensers?
So initially, it was something that Michael Kremer and Dan Miguel and collaborators tried out in Western Kenya,
yeah,
and they found that it worked pretty well. And then it's been kind of like rolled out in many other contexts by an organization called Evidence Action that has really, mm-hmm, done a massive work scaling that up. And so in the context of their programs, typically the dispensers managed by agents, like community agents, whose job it is to keep those dispensers refilled. And the idea is really just like when you go to a public bathroom and there is a soap dispenser right next to where your water comes out. It's a very similar system. You can do one or two push or three, and then you get exactly the right dosage that you need for your jerrycan. And so in practice, making sure that these dispensers are consistently filled, obviously, is important. But that's what Evidence Action has been working on.
Do they find in practice that everybody takes advantage of this?
So not everybody takes advantage of this. Some households simply don't like the taste of chlorine in the water. Now, in principle, if you dose it exactly right, you don't test it too much, but it depends. You know, some some folks live in Princeton, say they don't like the taste of the water that comes out of the tap. And so they, you know, they want to drink bottled water. It doesn't bother me, but everybody has their own issues with whatever water test. So some households don't want to use it. Sometimes people may just forget. Again, it's very natural that something that you have to do every time, you would think, well, it becomes instinctive, a habit that you have.
Yeah.
Yes, to some extent it can be, but it's also often we forget to do things or we just rush. And so the same way, I think studies that put cameras in bathrooms, in airport or something like that, to see if people truly wash their hands when they come out of, of the bathroom is less than 2/3, I think. But the idea is that it's there. So if you want it, it's there for you. You don't want it, you don't use it, but it's available. So people have the opportunity to use it if they want.
It's one example of what we see quite often in these public health interventions. Something's free, it's extremely effective, but there's not necessarily 100% take up because of all these details, because of people's habits, how difficult it is to change behavior.
In contexts where the disease burden is high and the environment isn't healthy, there are so many things you have to do on a daily basis. You have to treat your water, you have to put the bed above your bed. The burden is huge. Imagine that you send your kids to fetch the water once in a while, then maybe, you know, the kids don't understand what this is, or you're afraid that they're not going to dose it well, they're going to play with it and keep pushing the button and put way too much chlorine in it. So you say, okay, don't do it. There are many reasons why it can be tricky. That's why I don't think we should be obsessed with 100% being what we want. I think we should just think about, okay, make this available to people. If you don't use it, it doesn't cost you anything.
So there are also many other interventions that look at introducing chlorine to the water in the household. We did an episode based on Malawi, where health workers bring the chlorine to households and they offer education about the benefits of it and how well it works and how to put it in the water. Is that more successful? Does that increase the take up?
So typically it's like different households that are going to be targeted by these different methods. The households that don't actually fetch water from a central place, there's no dispensers near them, then the only option for them would be to have the chlorine at home. They don't have a dispenser. They just have to use this capful and fill it themselves and treat it themselves. And so for that, one question is, how do you make sure that they have it at home? And the shelf life of the product is not tiny, but it's not humongous either. So you can't just give them a supply that's going to last for the first 5 years of their child's life. They would have to, like, at least every 6 months get a refill. And so the question is, how do you get that into people's homes? So one option is to use community health workers who already, in many contexts, visit households to distribute them. And so when they distribute them, they can also provide some information. Another option is to tell households that if they want to use a product, they can redeem a coupon or something like that for a free bottle at the health facility or some other central point or a store nearby. And so again, the idea is that if a health worker comes to your house and say, hey, you should retreat your water, here's a product, you know, you would be a bad mother if you don't use it. I'm going to take it because I don't want you to judge me and to tell me, well, you're not taking it. So then actually you may end up reducing a little bit the cost effectiveness because you may end up dropping it down to people's lap, even if they really have no intention to use a product because of taste issues or because of not trusting that. I didn't bring that up yet, but obviously there's a legacy of horrible stuff done by various colonial powers in sub-Saharan Africa over the course of the 20th century. And in some areas, it has led to serious mistrust of some of the medicines or products that are being pushed on people. And so you don't want to take this mistrust lightly. It's a serious, but very good reasons to not necessarily trust what's pushed on them. If they don't trust that this is good for them and you just push it on them, they just say, yes, thank you, they're going to take it and then throw it down the latrine.
Yeah.
You're wasting your money doing that. So the advantage of using the voucher system, the coupon system, is that you let people decide for themselves. You know, if they want the product, they want the subsidy, they just pay this small, tiny time cost of going to redeem the voucher in the local spot where they can redeem. And you won't get 100% take up. In the studies we've done in Malawi, in Kenya, it's more like 30%. And that's a case where actually trying to push more education and telling people, yes, you should really do it, doesn't really help that much. So the community health workers, even if they try to add pressure, if you will, mm-hmm. we didn't see that it made that much of a difference. It seemed like it's pretty understanding germ theory. It's not that complicated once people have been told the idea that water can be contaminated, even if it's not turbid, mm-hmm. even if it looks transparent, it can still have contaminants. Once you've explained that to people, they can really get it. And you explain that you can treat that with chlorine, they really get it. Then it's their choice whether or not to use it or not. So you want to make sure they have that information, but then just doing like persuasion over and over, I've not found that to make a difference. But again, you know, whether you want to see a 30% take up as a glass half full or half empty, I think it's all about how can we get as many kids as we can healthier. And that's just one method to get, even if it's 30% of households to do it, it's totally worth it because it's very cost effective.
Has there been research on how you frame those benefits to make the take-up more effective?
So people have looked into framing things in terms of averaged treatment costs or averaged mortality, which is called like positive framing, negative framing, all sorts of stuff. I think they, specifically for this water stuff, I'm not sure that there are any clear results coming out, but it really depends on the context. So there is no, you know, one size fits all. To me, it seems like just making sure that people have all the information that they need. And so both the information about what it means in terms of health, what it means in terms of averaged healthcare costs is good. And any tweaking that you can do at the margin of the message, some behavioral responses, I think it's going to be very, very small.
If I was to put you in charge of progress towards Development Goal 6, Pascaline, what mix of policies would you recommend?
I'm not in charge, but I'm trying to put pressure on the people in charge.
Yeah.
I have thought about this quite a bit, and I think it's really important. So maybe the first thing that I would stress is that we've already talked about how water treatment has historically been neglected, and we really have to change that now even more than ever, because we didn't touch on this, but climate change is making things worse.
Of course.
Because climate change is increasing threats to water safety and health. So we really have to do something now. So what would I do? You know, it's not about having a fixed budget and thinking about how to allocate it across different possibilities. You want to do everything. In contexts where chlorine dispensers are the right thing to do because enough households all get the water from the same source, you want to do dispensers. In areas where, especially in urban areas, where it's possible to mobilize the financing to build out pipe water infrastructure, then you want to do that because if you have pipe water, you can treat the water in the pipes. That's obviously the way we get clean water in Princeton or in the UK. But right now, most low-income contexts don't necessarily have that, even when there is pipe water. So you want to do pipe water and then treat at the source. But expanding access to pipe water would be also one way to expand access. That's where the take-up issue that we just talked about is not there. Because if the water is treated at the source, it comes out of your tap, having been treated, you as a household don't have to do anything. Okay, so that's where you get, if you will, 100% take-up, as long as there is no recontamination inside the pipes. So that's sort of great. It's just a much higher cost initially, setup cost because of the infrastructure. But there are definitely some contexts where that's what you want to do. Even we should anticipate urbanization, anticipate people coming from rural areas to urban areas and already prepare the areas around cities to be able to receive very many new migrants in conditions where you already have laid out the pipes and the sanitations. And then the third thing for the households who are in super rural areas, who are still going to be rural for a while, for whom dispensers are not an option, then integrating safe water treatment subsidies into the maternal and child health standard package is what I'm pushing for. And so that would mean, you know, the same way you're a pregnant woman, you go for prenatal care. Nowadays, you get a bed net for free in almost all countries. You get vaccinations when your kids are very small. You get folic acid supplementation, iron supplementation, all sorts of stuff. Pushing for governments to also put in safe water treatment as part of the standard package. That means you come for prenatal care. You're told now, you know, from now on until your child is five, every month you can get this bottle of chlorine. And how you want to operationalize that? Is it that you want the mother to come every month to get it? Or you want to use a CHW, the community health workers to deliver? You know, depending on the context, you can figure that stuff out. We are currently working with JPA Africa on trying to work with governments to set that up. It requires tweaking in every single context, but it's totally doable. And again, like super cost effective. So I would just go with a three-pronged approach, type water, treated the dispensers, and integration in the maternal and child health program.
I've heard you speak, Pascaline, and I know that you can be pretty persuasive, but this has had a long history of relative neglect. From your experience so far, how much progress do you think it will be possible to make by 2030, which is, of course, the Sustainable Development Goals deadline?
I'm very hopeful that a lot of progress can be made. Some of the push we've been able to make, or that we are making right now with Michael Kremer and collaborators, is in part because of support we've received from a very large philanthropic organization called GiveWell that's very interested in this. It's put a lot of resources into clean water, and they are very influential because they do very, very careful analysis. Their interest to me is a sign that others are going to follow. We've had conversation with various organizations, you know, the World Bank and the UN, and this is something that really is coming to the forefront. People are paying attention. It could be because the other sources of mortality have gone down. This is really now, you know, right top of the agenda. But I think with climate change coming into the picture, we don't have a choice. It just has to happen. And I think we're going to get there.
I hope you do get there. Thank you.
I hope so too. Thank you so much.
If you want to know more about this, then the best source is called Pairing Insights from Engineering, Public Health and Behavioural Science to Improve Access to and Use of Clean Water. And you will find that at www.povertyactionlab.org. And if you want to know more about what the United Nations is worrying about, then the article The World is Off Track to Meet Its Sustainable Water Goal by 2030 is published by UN University, which is unu.edu. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. Best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And always, our past episodes are at voxdev.org. If you like what you're hearing, then leave us a review as well and tell other people about Vox Dev Talks.